Blog Talk Radio.
Horror enthusiasts and fans of things that go bump in the night, rejoice, as there is a new collection of creepy tales to keep your spine tingling and your blood running cold. The brainchild of prolific author Yvonne Mason. Welcome to Your Nightmare is an anthology of stories from a gifted batch of writers specializing in keeping you up at night. Whether you love gruesome tales of murder and mayhem, or you prefer quaint tales of scary happenings, welcome to Your Nightmare is sure to please the inner psychopath and whet even the most insatiable horror appetite. Welcome to Your Nightmare is available now on Amazon.com.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. It's Friday night, and this is Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason, and that was my ad man, Chris Dunham, doing one of his beautiful ads for me. The book is called Welcome to Your Nightmare. It is an anthology of short stories of horror, spooky stories, not-so-spooky stories, written by a whole gaggle of my author friends who, when I put the call out, I expected maybe 10 or 12, maybe even 5. So, yeah, I want to do one. Well, we had 32 authors that wanted to participate in an anthology. So we did Welcome to Your Nightmare, and then we split up the stories and made a second anthology called Satan's Holiday. So you never know when you put a call out what kind of response you're going to get, and I have been severely blessed by my writer friends that like to come and play with me and write stories with me so that I can help them get the exposure they need. Because some of those writers, they'd never written before. It was the first time for them, and that was so exciting. So go and download it, Welcome to Your Nightmare, on your Kindle, or even buy it in paperback form, because you will not be disappointed. Because not only did I have some unknown authors, I also had a very well-known gentleman who is a friend of mine named Nicholas Grabowski. He's been in the business for well over 20-some-odd years, close to 30 years. And we put his story in both anthologies. So if you know anything about Nicholas Grabowski, you will want to get this book and read his short story as well. Now, as all of y'all know, I love doing my numbers for this show. It excites me because when I see the numbers go up, I see that the guests that I have on here are being successful. They're being heard. Right now, we're heard in over 53 countries. And this morning when I ran the numbers, we were at 6,834 listeners just on Blog Talk Radio, just on the show itself. That didn't include all of the podcasts that this thing runs on. It runs on iTunes and YouTube and Stitcher, FM.com, TuneIn Radio, Podcast.com, Podomatic, Podcast Garden, MixCloud, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. So when you add all of those up and put that with the 6,834 listeners just on the show, we're at 15,658 listeners. Now, ladies and gentlemen, y'all all know, those of you that have been with me since the inception of this show, I wanted to get to 15,000 by the end of this year. Well, we have gone over that a tad. So my next goal for the end of the year is 20,000. As of right now, we are only 4,342 listeners away from that goal, and we have not even been on the air for a year yet, and it is so exciting. I can't tell you how exciting it is. And I have to debut something on this show. You're hearing it first, ladies and gentlemen, on this show. On Sunday nights from 8 to 9 o'clock, there is a show that is going to be played. It's already pre-recorded, and it's called Rockin' the Chain. And this show is about an hour long, and all I do on this show is play music from some of the musicians that I have interviewed. and other musicians who come to me and said, Yvonne, will you play my music? So be ready to rock the chain on Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. You will not be disappointed, I promise. Now, with that being said, let's move on to tonight's fun. My guest tonight, when I did my homework on her, I have not read her books yet, but I'm going to tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, my little fingers are itching to hop over to Amazon and get those books. No, y'all cannot go now. You got to wait. Because she writes in such a way that you just want to crawl into that book and be an observer. She does a lot of her homework. She does a lot of her research, and I can't wait to delve into it. Author Judy Penns Shelock. See, I knew I was going to massacre. It's that time of night, folks. Y'all know what happens to me at this time of night. Judy Penns, P-E-N-Z, Shelock, S-H-E-L-U-K. Write that down, because I promise you after the show you're going to be running over to Amazon. Her debut mystery novel, The Hanged Man's Noose, was published in July of 2015. Skeletons in the Attic, the first book in her Marketville mystery series, was published in August of this year. So it's a brand new book. Judy's short crime fiction appears in World Enough and Crime, The Whole Shebang 2, The Whole Shebang 3, Flash and Bang, and Live Free or Try. Judy is a member of Sisters in Crime, Crime Writers of Canada, International Thriller Writers, and the Short Mystery Fiction Society. Now, a little bit more about Judy, in that she, if I'm not mistaken, lived in Canada, moved to the States, moved back to Canada, and now she's back. So we are glad she's back. Thank you for being on my show, Judy. I can't wait for us to have fun tonight.
It's good to be here.
So, did I get it right? You lived in Canada and then came and then went back and then came back, or did I get that one wrong?
No, you got that one wrong. I was born in Toronto, and I've lived within 2 hours of Toronto ever since. I have worked for American companies and traveled to the States a lot before I became an author, but I've actually never lived in the United States.
Oh, okay, so I misread. I apologize, ladies and gentlemen. See, that's what happens. That's why I always ask my guest. So how in the world your love of crime fiction and mysteries – was this something you wanted to do when you were little? Was it a journey you knew you were going to take? How did you get here? Because this to me is so exciting, especially once we get into how you do your research to do your novels.
Sure. Well, as a young kid, my mom used to work at a Zeller's department store in the toy department, and every payday she would buy me a Nancy Drew book. And so I, you know, that's what I grew up reading, and I coveted those books, and I always sort of thought one day I might want to write a book like that, but I didn't for many years. You know, it's like you always say you're going to do this or that, but you don't really end up doing a lot of these things that you know, I ended up actually becoming a credit manager. This is about as far away from writing murder mysteries as you can get, although I did maybe, you know, want to murder some of my clients. But anyway, so it wasn't until probably about 15 years ago that I just thought, you know, I think I'd like to try my hand at writing. And so I took some courses and became a freelance writer first, left the credit world and became a freelance writer for magazines. And that's where I learned to research, right, because I wrote about many, many things, everything from codeine to porta potties.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, and I specialize in antiques. I know quite a bit about antiques, and I've been the senior editor at New England Antiques Journal since 2008.
Now, when, for people that don't understand what freelance writing encompasses, Would you explain that to them? Because I can already hear it now. Oh, I can go do freelance. And, well, ladies and gentlemen, I don't think it's as easy as you might think it is. Would that be a true statement, Judy?
Yes. And when I started, Yvonne, it was easier. There was more print opportunities. That would have been 2003 that I left the corporate world and decided that I wasn't going to ever do 9-to-5 again. And so it was easier then. There were a lot more print opportunities. Online was just sort of emerging. People paid you for your writing. Today there are a lot of places like Huffington Post, for example, they don't pay their writers. So, you know, great if you've got 10 things in Huffington Post, but you can't feed yourself
right.
on bylines, right? So it was easier for me, I think. But also, there's pros and cons. Obviously, if you're freelancing, you're self-employed, so there are no benefits. There's no security, and every time you've got a job, you're already looking for your next job. So the best way to ensure that you get a job is to be reliable, get the work in on time, be familiar with the magazines that you're writing for, so you're writing appropriate material. So that I would say, as an editor, that's the biggest mistake I see people make when they try to pitch an idea to me is, you know, they'll say, well, you know, I've got this great story for, a sailboat that went across the Hudson River or something. You know, that's got nothing to do with antiques, so who cares? Like, you know, maybe it's a good story, but it doesn't matter, right? So I think there's a lot more to it than people realize, and there's a lot of rejection, which really helped me when I decided to become an author, because there's really a lot of rejection when you're trying to find a place for your books.
That is true. And getting back to people pitching, if they don't do their homework for magazines, newspapers, periodicals, whatever, that's like walking blind into an interview and saying, I want to come to work for you, but what is it that you do now?
Exactly. It's exactly like that. But people don't always look at it that way. And actually, that makes another great point, Yvonne, is that you would never go into a job interview dressed in pajama pants and, well, maybe you would, but no, you wouldn't. You would not go to a job interview dressed in pajama pants with absolutely no idea what the company did or anything about them. And you would treat the person that was interviewing you with some sort of respect. You know, you would say, hello, Mr. Smith, or hello, Mrs. So-and-so. But you'd be surprised at how many people will email, because they feel it's a different medium, and they'll go, hey, Jude, just thought I'd check and see if you'd be interested in, you know, a story about fly fishing. Like, you have to be you still have to be professional in your approach, you know, because you're one of many, many people trying to get this job, right? So if you don't treat it like a job, you're not going to be successful no matter how good your idea is. I think that's the biggest thing. Like, spell the editor's name right. That's really important. And do your homework. Absolutely do your homework and treat it like every single assignment, like a job. And if you do that, I was very successful as a freelance writer, but I treated every assignment like a new job. And the people that I interviewed, I made sure I did research on them before I spoke to them, so that, you know, the questions that I asked were relevant. I think that's all part of it. It's a lot more to it, and it doesn't pay particularly well. So, you know, people are thinking, well, there's an easy fix. No, these stories of, you know, Carrie Bradshaw and Sex and the City making, I don't know what, she was making some crazy amount of money, $400 a word or something. You're lucky to make 10 cents a word, right? So
exactly.
That's quite a bit different. I'm not buying any of those fancy shoes, okay? I'm not buying those shoes with the red soles.
Well, and what it slays me, because like you, I am old school. I started working at 5 years old and in my father's business, because I answered his his business phone. Now, I wasn't even in school yet, but I could write because my mother taught me to write, and there were four stair steps under me. So I had, as the oldest, I had to help pick up the slack. So at 5 years old, I'm answering a business phone in a business manner, and I would not anymore think about sending you that type of email than I would fly backwards.
Exactly.
That's the best way to get the door slammed in your face.
Absolutely.
Mercy, I can't believe it. And about fly fishing in an antique magazine? Okay. How is that relevant?
Yeah. Exactly.
Now,
exactly.
Go ahead.
I think people, they think they have a great idea, but the same principle can be applied to books or looking for publishing houses. You know, if you have a book that's, say, a romantic novel, then there is absolutely no point sending that book, no matter how good it is. It could be fabulous, but no matter how good it is, there's no point sending it to a publishing house that specializes in mysteries. And conversely, there's no point sending a mystery to a publishing house that specializes in romance. You have no chance, because that's not what they're interested in publishing. So save yourself the heartache of an unnecessary rejection. You're going to get plenty of necessary rejections. At least try not to get the unnecessary ones. Do your homework, right? That's the best advice you can give anybody that's aspiring to write.
And be professional.
Absolutely.
Them Mr. or Ms. or Mrs. first and last name, with the address header, the company header, the date, and dear so-and-so, my name is so-and-so.
Right.
Introduce yourself.
And
you wouldn't walk into an interview and say, hey, Jude, I'm coming after that job.
No, and the thing is, too, not only that, but you also want to say, why are you there? So not just to say, would you, I've got this great idea for a book, but why would that publisher be interested in it? You would say, I have this fabulous romance novel. I know that it would be great for your house because I've read this author, this author, this author that you published, and in my book is similar to that and that and that. So that now that you've got something that they know, okay, they've done their homework, they've read some of our titles, they know what we do, they're comparing their book. Now don't compare it to say it's the best thing since War and Peace or something, don't be ridiculous. Just say, I believe my book would be a good fit, or my story for your magazine would be a good fit because I noticed that, you tend to cover a lot about, this particular period, and I'm writing about, something made in that particular period. But always drill it back to who you're sending your idea to. And that always drills back to doing your homework. And in the case of getting a book published, it means reading some of those books that have been published by that publishing company and seeing. There's a good reason for doing that. Maybe you read those books and say, I don't even like their books. I don't even want to be published by them. That's possible.
Very
right?
true. That is
yeah.
A,
so
is
you're doing homework
good.
For yourself as well. You're not just doing
yes.
homework for them. You're doing homework for yourself.
That is an excellent point, because once you get in there, you think, well, maybe I need to rewrite my book because that's really not where I wanted to go. I just thought I did.
Exactly. And, also if you belong to associations, like you notice I belong to Sisters in Crime, Crime Writers of Canada, International Thriller Writers, and all these different associations. And, the cost varies from nothing, as in International Thriller Writers, to maybe $100 a year. And it can seem like a lot of money until you realize that the benefit of that is that you've now developed this huge network of like-minded people. And so if you have a question, you've got people that you can ask, people that are in the industry, and you can say to them, what would you recommend, or do you recommend this publisher? And you will likely get an honest answer off the main list type of thing, right? So I'm a big believer in belonging to associations because I think they do a lot to promote their particular genres, and they also are there as a resource for the writer. So I really think that it's a must have expense. You must do it.
And it's also a place where you can go and bounce your ideas, your settings, your plot lines, your characters off of to get feedback in the vein that you are needing, wanting, desiring for that particular genre that you're getting ready to write in. Would that be true?
In some cases, yes. Like, for instance, Sisters in Crime has a branch called Guppy, which stood for Great Unpublished. Now, they have all types of courses that have been so greatly subsidized that like a $200 course is maybe $25, right?
Ah.
They teach you everything from creating a website to suspense, plot development, how to master dialogue, you know, any number of things. And these things courses are taught by well-known authors, and the association subsidizes them. And to belong to Sisters in Crime, Guppy is only $18 a year. I mean, it's like,
wow,
you know, a few cups of coffee and you're there, right? So, so it's, I just think there's so much. And Crime Writers of Canada, I'm going to be on their board of directors for 2017, 2018, starting in at the end of this month. And they do a lot of, lobby work, like, you know, on copyright protection for authors and a lot of stuff that maybe we take for granted, but the way the world is today with internet and et cetera, like it's not as safe as it used to be, right? So they're lobbying for safer ways of protecting authors and their work.
Yeah, because if you go on the internet, and I found several of my books on these sites where they're quote unquote free sites. They put a person's work up to be downloaded for free. Well, that's all well and good, except that to me it's piracy. And number one, we worked hard to get our work out there. And what we do in our craft is not an easy thing on a good day, much less a bad day when the voices won't talk to you. And then for someone to take our work and give it away without our permission.
It's stealing.
It is.
It's stealing. No sooner would you, like, you know, one day I always tell the story. My husband is, you know, he's a law-abiding citizen. He was an engineer for many years. You know, so he's smart. But, you know, one day he went to the flea market, came home with The Revenant, that movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. But here was the thing. The Revenant was still in the theaters. So I said to him, well, Mike, you know, how'd you get that? It's still in the theaters. And he goes, well, the guy sold it. He goes, well, it's probably like a pirated copy. I go, you cannot bring that in this house. I mean, I'm an author. Like, I fight against these things. Like, you know, and he goes, well, Leonardo makes all kinds of money. I said, but what about all the other people? I said, you would not go into Walmart, take The Revenant off the stack and stick it in your pocket. But that's what you're doing. You're stealing, right? So he's never bought another one of those bootleg copies again, or at least if he has, he hasn't told me.
And that's, it's sad that, and it happens to musicians all the time as well.
It happens to musicians all the time too. And the thing is, it's not just the big names that are being affected, but all the people that worked on those films or books, they're all being affected because they've all got a stake in it. And you would not expect, if you were a bank teller, to work all week and then at the end of the week to be told, oh yeah, you know, we've decided that we're not going to pay you this week. I mean, how would that go over? But so I'm hoping that, you know, associations like Sisters in Crime, Crime Writers of Canada, they try to, you know, work with governments to implement, you know, stronger legislation to hopefully, you know, at least mitigate some of that. I don't think you can ever stop it anymore. I mean, I think that horse has left the barn. But, you know, at least educate people and hopefully protect, you know, artists a little bit more. Yeah.
And it's gone from, sadly, especially with musicians, it's gone from being raped and pillaged by their managers and the record label companies to being raped and pillaged by people on the internet.
Exactly. It's not easy, really. It's not easy being an artist of any sort in today's digital world, that's for sure. But you know, there are still, I think, the majority of people are honest individuals who will pay for the product they consume, right? And that's what we've got to, that's what we've got to believe, But
it means more. It means more.
It does.
Now, on to the meat of the yes, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk about our books. Just y'all, just chill out a minute here. When you wrote the first book, The Hanged Man's Noose,
mm-hmm.
tell us about the research that you put into that book.
Sure. Well, the premise is that it's one that many people can relate to, in that at the time I was living in a fairly small town that had grown quite a bit. It became quite a commuter town to Toronto. When I moved there, it was more of a rural type of atmosphere. But as, you know, Toronto sprawled out and housing got more expensive, more people came to the area. And so suddenly we found that, you know, the big box stores coming in, right? And the big box stores, I mean, I shop at them myself, but they do harm small business because small business can't compete against, you know, a huge box store like a Lowe's or a Home Depot or whatnot. So it was happening in my little town of Holland Landing, and so this book is set in the fictionalized version of it, which is Lounce Landing. And I thought, and what if, you know, on the town's main street, which is very historic and has all these independent shops and restaurants, what if, you know, a developer came with plans to build a big box store? And what if somebody on that street was willing to kill him for it? So that was basically the result of that. But it was actually based on stuff I'd seen. You know, I'd seen businesses go under because of big box coming in. And I think we've all seen that. Even in Toronto, which is a huge city, there are communities within that huge city that are, you know, they have little names like Little Italy and Little Greece and Chinatown and whatnot, right? And within those small communities are independent shops, which could easily get trampled by like a large box store, right? So that's where sort of the premise came from. Now, the Glass Dolphin, it's a Glass Dolphin Museum. Glass Dolphin is actually an antiques shop. And again, I drew on my experience as the senior editor at New England Antiques Journal. So a lot of that research had already been done, you know, over the years, and I just really had to go back to old articles or whatever. Now, a bonus of being a freelance writer and an editor for many years is that I'm not afraid to call somebody an expert and ask for their information or opinion. I'd rather do that than get the data wrong. So if there's something that I don't know or I'm not 100% sure of, you know, I don't really trust Wikipedia all that much, so I will go to somebody that I know is an expert in, you know, sandwich glass or, you know, antique guns or what have you, and I'll say, you know, this is what I'm thinking. Is that accurate? How would I describe it? You know, how would somebody use that? What would the value be today? And what I find is that experts are generally very generous with their time because they want you to get the facts right, and they also are proud of their knowledge and want to share it. So certainly it's easier once you've got a little bit of a name going for you. People are more willing to talk to you if you have a book published or something because they, you know, they know that you're the real deal. But I do think that research is so important because I don't know about you, but if you've ever read a book where there's a fact in there that's just so wrong, it just, you know, it just ruins the whole book for you.
That's true, it does, because, and this is what I tell people that want to publish. I say, look, if you're going to do a book, make sure you get in a location you don't live in. Let's just say somebody from where I live in St. Lucie County wants to write a book about somewhere in Atlanta. Well, if they've never been to Atlanta, Atlanta encompasses a large area. You have to define, number one, where you want to put the setting, and number two, you better make sure that the setting is what it's supposed to be, because people that have been there will nail you in a heartbeat for being wrong, and then that, like you say, it just ruins the entire story for them.
Absolutely. Now, that's why both my books are set in fictional towns. Now, they are fictionalized versions of places I've lived, but because they're fictionalized, I've been able to take liberties with them, which I think is good. But I definitely do mention, you know, real places. And I think you're absolutely right. And it can't be something like if you're writing about Atlanta and you haven't been there in 20 years, well, you know, you better do a refresher trip because things have probably changed, you know.
I'm from Atlanta. I went back. I've been in Florida since 2006. I've been in Florida for 11 years. Well, I went back to the county that I was living in before I moved down here. And it's a little town in a county in northeast Georgia, and my daughters still live there. I said, "What the hell happened to this city?"
Yeah, exactly.
Same city.
It's
and
exactly.
And Atlanta's even worse.
Yeah, because it things change, you know. Like I don't go to Toronto that often anymore because I live about 90 minutes north in a small town. But once a year, I meet my high school girlfriend. We were best friends since grade 10, and she lives like sort of 90 minutes the other way. So we meet once a year in Toronto. And we do like Toronto things. And last year we were like, okay, well we'll meet where that radio store was. Well, that radio store wasn't there anymore. We're both sort of wandering around the neighborhood like, well, where did that radio store go to? But it's true. Things change so fast, right?
And it's minute by minute now, Judy. It's not.
Oh yeah.
Month by month. Between technology and buildings and roads, it's such a
and condos.
Yes.
Condos. Toronto must get a new condo every week. It looks like, right? So because they're building up because there's land is just so valuable now. So.
It's ridiculous. But the Hanged Man's Noose. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I have the synopsis, so hang on. I'm going to read it to you because I can't wait to go get this book. I'm telling you, I'm getting this book tonight. It's called The Hanged Man's Noose. Journalist Emily Garland lands a plum assignment as the editor of a niche magazine based in Lounce Landing, a small town named after a colorful Canadian trader. See, she grabbed me right there in that first sentence. As she interviews local business owners for the magazine, Emily quickly learns that many people are unhappy with real estate mogul Garrett Stonehaven's plans to convert an old schoolhouse into a mega box store. At the top of that list is Arabella Carpenter, the outspoken owner of the Glass Dolphin Antique Shop, who will do just about anything to preserve the integrity of the town's historic main street. But Arabella is not alone in her opposition. Before long, a vocal dissenter, at a town hall meeting about the proposed project dies. And the plot thickens. A few days later, another body is discovered, and although both deaths are ruled accidental, Emily's journalistic suspicions are aroused. Putting her reporting skills to the ultimate test, Emily teams up with Arabella to discover the truth behind Stonehaven's latest scheme before the murderer strikes again. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is where the Glass Dolphin comes in. And what Judy did is the production of Dolphin Six, and I want you to go into that for me for a little bit, if you will, Judy, because that in itself is amazing. This is what we were talking about in doing research on antiques. Tell the folks about these Dolphin Sticks.
Sure. So Arabella has always wanted to own an antique shop. Her ex-husband, Levon, is an antiques picker, much like the guys you might see on Antique Pickers on History TV or whatever. That's what he does. So these cobalt blue Boston sandwich glass candlesticks in the shape of a dolphin were her first antique find years ago. And so she's never going to sell these. They're in the window of her shop. But if you were to look up Boston and Sandwich dolphin candlesticks, you would see pictures of them. They're absolutely lovely. They're from the late 19th century. And a pair just recently sold at Jeffrey Evans' auction for $4,500. So they're not cheap. Yeah. So they're not cheap, but they're quite lovely. And the Boston Sandwich Company was very was in business from about 1840 till early 1890s. Then they had their employees went on strike and the company folded. So it's sort of like the same story that you might find today, only 100 and something years ago, really. I've always thought they were one of my first freelance assignments was on the Boston Sandwich Company, and I really loved a lot of their stuff. I just thought it was really beautiful, and that was always sort of an idea for me. And it, ironically, I was actually going to call it the Blue Dolphin Antique Shop, but there is actually a Blue Dolphin Antique Shop in Maine, and I didn't want to get sued, so I called it the Glass Dolphin.
That is so neat. Now, see, ladies and gentlemen, what we're talking about, how Judy incorporated what she knew, what she studied, what she's written about in freelancing into her book because she already had the history on it, and it fits this story amazingly well. See, I'm already reading it in my mind, and I ain't got the book yet. So, yeah, after we're off here, I'm getting that book and her second one, which debuted in August of 2016, Skeletons in the Attic. Now, this one is just from reading the synopsis of this one, I'm ready to crawl under the covers with a cup of tea and read this one. What goes on behind closed doors doesn't always stay there. Calamity, Callie Barnstable, isn't surprised to learn that she's the sole beneficiary of her late father's estate, though she is shocked to discover that she has inherited a house in the town of Marketville, a house she didn't know existed. However, there are conditions attached to Callie's inheritance. She must move to Marketville, live in the house, and solve her mother's murder. Callie's not keen on dredging up a 30-year-old mystery, but if she doesn't do it, there's a scheming psychic named Misty Rivers who is more than happy to expose the Barnstable family's secrets. Determined to thwart Misty and fulfill her father's wishes, Callie accepts the challenge, but is she ready to face the skeletons hidden in the attic? Now, I went on your website, and Calamity is an interesting name for this character. Tell the folks how you came up with Calamity.
Well, that's an interesting story, actually. I didn't really have a name for the – the idea for the story actually came to me when I was in our lawyer's office with my husband. We were going to update our wills. And our lawyer was in court. And, so while my husband was reading old bicycling magazines, I was thinking, what if I was here and I wasn't here to update a will? What if I was here to inherit from a will? What if this? What if that? So I sort of came up with that whole premise of, inheriting this house that she didn't know about and then, finding out that her mother had actually disappeared 30 years ago when she thought she had just left for, a milkman or whatever. So by the time my lawyer actually arrived, I'd sort of written down like maybe 10 pages of notes, right? And actually the opening scenes from that book are really culled directly from that experience of sitting in the lawyer's office because it starts with her sitting in the lawyer's office waiting for the lawyer to come from court. I went off so off on a tangent, I've sort of forgotten what you would ask. Oh, it's Calamity. So anyway, but just before that, so again with my antiques, there was an auction of old Western memorabilia, and one of the items was an old carte de visite, the sort of business cards of the 19th century, which were basically like a postcard, and it was of Calamity Jane, who was a Wild Western frontierswoman. And it sold for some ridiculous amount, $2,000 or something. But I just sort of thought she looked really manly and butchy and everything. And I thought, oh, isn't that interesting? And she actually disguised herself as a man for many years. But then I sort of kept researching, and I found out that Calamity Jane had been made into a movie starring Doris Day. So you just can just see Doris Day was this pretty little blonde thing, and you know, playing Calamity Jane. So they obviously Hollywoodized Calamity quite a bit. But I sort of thought, wouldn't it be neat to have a character that was named after that Calamity Jane, the movie, because the mom maybe was really into old 50s movies. And that's sort of how it all spawned. So really, sometimes you just never know. Like, one sort of odd fact will just sort of lead you to who knows where. And that, and then I just thought, well, nobody really wants to be called Calamity, so she became Callie. But so.
That is too neat. It's so, again, ladies and gentlemen, this is how our minds work as artists. We find stories in the strangest places.
Absolutely,
and
we do. Yeah.
Do you carry a notebook with you?
Always.
Everywhere you go.
Everywhere in my purse, I always have a notebook, and next to my bed, on my night table, I have a note. Like a notebook, and I have a pen that actually has an LED light in it, so that I don't have to turn the bedroom light on. I can just turn on my pen and write my notes. And my husband got a bit tired of the light flashing on in the middle of the night, so he bought me a whole pack of these LED pens.
Smart man.
Yeah, I know, and they're great. Like, you could literally just turn it on, and it's just enough to light up the page, because you know what it's like. You might not be able to get an idea all day, and as soon as you lie down, it pops in your head, right? And it's because you're finally stopping to overthink it, and your subconscious is, like, saying to you, you know, this is what you need to do. You got to go here and there. And sometimes, too, like when I'm writing and I'm stuck somewhere and I can't seem to get past that, I believe it's because my mind is saying, well, that's because you're going in the wrong direction. You should be going a different way. And so until you kind of accept that, you stay blocked at that point, right? So I find that if I'm really blocked, if I go for a walk with my dog, or I, you know, at night I lie down, that's when my ideas come to me, because then I'm not trying to overthink it. I'm just letting my mind kind of just find the loose ends.
I call it letting the voices have their way, because they seem to shut up when I'm trying to take a story in a direction they don't really want to go.
Absolutely right. It's your subconscious telling you you're going the wrong way, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if we listen to that, then we have a better story, right? So I've never been able to outline. I know people that are great outliners. They know, like, from start to finish where they're going to go with their story. And I think that must be really much easier than the way I do it. But I can't do it that way, because I might want to go a certain direction. Say I want to go to New York. But maybe along the way I see, oh, there's this little town that was going to take me to somewhere in Quebec that looks kind of nice. I think I'd rather go there, and then maybe I'll go to New York a bit later. Like, I want to meander my way to where I'm going. And so with an outline, you know, you're basically just following your map and going there, point A, point B. You're seeing the historic sites you said you were going to see. I don't know. I guess that's okay, but I sort of like the meandering approach myself.
Yeah, I do too,
but it does take longer.
I find the straight line kind of boring.
Yeah, exactly. It's just sort of fun. You never know where your mind is going to take you. And, you know, and it's true that if you don't have an outline, you may end up sort of going off on a tangent and have to cut a bunch of stuff out. But at least you, I don't know, I find my stories just, I want to be surprised. And so if I figure if I'm surprised and interested, my reader will be surprised and interested. And so what I write, I try to write a chapter a day. At the end of the chapter, I try to leave a little hook or some little interesting tidbit so that I can't wait to get up the next day and find out what happens and write it. And if I can't wait to find out, then when somebody starts reading it, they'll want to turn the pages, right? So I think, I want to entertain myself first and foremost, and if I do that, then I have a shot at entertaining a reader.
And I think this is what sometimes our readers don't understand, is when we're writing, sometimes we can be just as entertained as they are when they're reading, because you're like me. You have no idea what you're going to put on that piece of paper your computer until you sit down to do it, and all of a sudden the words start flowing, and I find myself catching all the emotions, anger, happiness, sadness, surprise, laughter, because I have no idea where it's coming from, but it's there and it works. And the stuff that I cut out sometimes goes to a different book altogether.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, nothing ever, like, that's the beauty of cut and paste. I think back, like, oh, aren't we lucky that we're in this age? Imagine if you had to do all this, like, with a typewriter and carbon paper and liquid paper. I mean, I don't know how they did it, quite frankly, or some of them, before a typewriter, when they had to handwrite everything, like, you know, I mean, I'm just, it boggles the mind to me that people did that. We're so spoiled with our cut and paste and save and all of that. And, yeah.
And move around and
and move around
and
just say, you know, this sentence would be better up here and that one down there. Yeah, I mean, I just think we're so lucky to live in an age where we've got this available to us. And so it just makes me admire all the more, you know, a writer like Agatha Christie, who I think is probably the best female crime writer ever. And, you know, she wrote, I don't know how many, 70 books or some outrageous amount of books, and, you know, just probably wrote longhand, like, just amazing.
The first book I ever wrote, I started writing it in the 70s and 80s, and finally published it in 2006, was written in longhand.
Really?
I still have the original manuscript that I wrote in longhand, and then I transferred it all to the computer. But when I got ready to take it out of draft and put it into finished form, but yeah, that entire book was written by longhand.
Well, no, I have done some of that. We have a cottage, a camp, I don't know, like, we call them cottages here in Canada, but I think in the U.S. you might call them a camp or a summer home, whatever. It's on Lake Superior, so it's in the United States side of it would be the Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And it's a good 8 to 10 hour drive from Toronto, so it's north, it's really north, right? But so when you go there, you're there for a while. You're not just there for a week, because, you know, it's like a long time to get there. But when I'm up there, I have a rule that I don't really allow technology up there. I don't want to be cell phoned and all this other nonsense, right? So I just bring my iPad and my notebook, and I handwrite everything, and then during the day when I'm sitting out at the dock or whatever, and in the morning I'll transcribe that onto my iPad, just to get the story down. But I found, like, writing it in longhand, once I could read my writing, I had to kind of clean that up, it's gotten a bit messy over the years. It's amazing how freeing that actually is, writing in longhand. It really is. It takes a lot longer, but it is very, very cathartic to actually write that way. And I think that when I wrote the sequel to Noose, which is coming out next March, most of it was written up at the cottage in longhand first.
And it's like, because the book, like you, the book I'm working on now, I started out making notes in the margin of things that I wanted to rearrange after I'd printed out the first six chapters. Then I caught myself 12 pages later, I had written four entire chapters in longhand.
Yeah, but see, that's your subconscious letting you go, right? Letting you free.
Uh-huh.
So I think, yeah, I think it's definitely something people should explore. If they're looking at writing and they're finding sitting at a computer screen a bit daunting, then try the longhand thing. It doesn't hurt to try things, right?
Well, and you can write anywhere. Yeah, we have, you know, the iPads and we have the laptops. But I agree with you. There is something about sitting down and writing that you don't worry about misspellings, you don't worry about sentence structure, you don't worry about content, as in, does this fit here? You just let it flow, and then when you go back to transcribe it, that's when you clean it up. But it's so refreshing just to write.
It is, yeah. It's wonderful. Maybe it reminds us back of, like, when we were in school or something. I don't know. Or when we were kids, you know. Like, when I was a kid, I used to, you know, write stories in a notebook, and I used to keep a diary and this type of thing, right? And, like, handwrite, you know. So maybe it brings us back to that time, right?
It could. But what is so sad, Judy, what breaks my heart more than anything is these young people that don't know how to write anymore.
Yeah, I think it, like, I'm hoping that things turn around. I think part of it is, like, everybody's so busy writing everything in text messages, and
uh-huh.
so that they've lost their sense of spelling and grammar, and that, you know, is tragic. It definitely is tragic. But I think schools are starting to bring it back. I've even heard that they're starting to bring cursive writing back, cursive handwriting back. Because a lot of people can't even sign their name now.
Like,
yeah,
and
I mean, it's craziness, right?
What people don't realize is there is nothing more beautiful than reading a story or a letter or something that is written in a beautiful cursive hand. It reminds one of a more romantic time, I guess, or a more slowed down time. There's just something neat about reading something that is handwritten. It's more personal, I think.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent that is true. And I think, like I said, I think at our cottage, like, I think people go to these places, you know, these resorts or whatever, and then they're on their cell phone for the whole time. Like,
uh-huh.
why did you even leave home then? Like, you know, if you're going to go camping and you have to be on your cell phone the whole time, like, stay in the city then. Don't come up here.
Don't worry about getting back
to
nature.
Like, you're trying to get away from it all. Get away from it all. Like embrace nature and, you know, really, you know, it's just so sad to me that now, like, all the campgrounds up here, you know, people are demanding that they have cell reception and Wi-Fi and all this stuff. And I'm like, why? Like, it's your time to not to unplug and not to have that, you know. So, but I guess, you know, people are so they're so dependent on it now that they're nervous not to have it. But I have that 2 or 3 weeks every summer where I just unplug, and I, you know, guess what? When I get back, nobody's really missed me.
And not only
you
that,
know?
But you've had a chance to, and as artists, we have to have that chance to regenerate, because so much of who we are goes into what we do that sometimes there's nothing left, along with everything else that we do, there's nothing left for us.
Exactly. Yeah, you need to, it's like charging your own personal battery is what it
uh-huh.
is. You need that, right? And cleansing your mind of everything. And then only then can you really, you know, when you free it of all the other clutter and everything, you that's when your great ideas come to you, because you're open to them now, right?
Exactly.
I highly recommend it. I get some people who can't do it, but, like, geez, don't, like, go for a walk for an hour and leave your phone at home. Like, it really, when you get back, you're not, unless you're a brain surgeon or something, you know, you'll be okay. You know, when you got somebody dying in the hospital, maybe you got to bring your phone. But otherwise, like, honestly, if people have to leave a message and wait for, like, 45 minutes, you know, the sun will come up in the morning, right?
Absolutely. Now, you're not going to believe this, but our hour is almost up.
I know.
It just flies by, especially when I have
it
some
does.
Yes. So what I want you to do, if you will, Judy, is let folks know where they can find you, because
yes.
you're going on my bestseller list, and I'm sure
okay.
the other folks can't wait. So let them know where they can find you. And, yes, ladies and gentlemen, Judy and I will stay in touch, because when she gets ready to launch her book by the end of the year, I'm bringing her back, so y'all don't get excited. She is coming back. So tell them where they can find you, my dear.
Okay, so I have a website, judypenzshelluck.com, so JudyPenzShelluk.com, and I interview other authors, and I have new release Mondays where I introduce a new release by different authors. I write about the writing life, all kinds of things, and there's all sorts of historical information on there, too, about research and that type of thing. I'm on Facebook as Judy Penshelic, and I'm on Pinterest as Judy Penshelic, and I'm on Twitter as Judy Penshelic. So Judy Penshelic will pretty much get you anywhere. And the Hangman's News, good news for everybody, is on sale right now in ebook format for $2.99 on all formats, Google Play, iTunes, Kindle, Kobo, Nook, until May 14th, so this is a good time to buy it. And Skeletons in the Attic is available in print and Kindle. Oh, Noose is also available in print. Yes. And Skeletons is available on Kindle and print and on Kindle Unlimited, if you happen to be a Kindle Unlimited person. So that's where you can find me in my books. And if you want to contact me through my website, ask any questions, I'm always happy to answer them.
So, see, ladies and gentlemen, I'm telling you, Judy and I have done it. You all can do it. I can't talk anymore. It's that time of night. If you have a dream, stop asking permission. If you want to achieve success and greatness, stop asking permission. Just go out and do it. And it's like Judy and I both have said, it is not going to be handed to you, and it's not going to be the easiest thing you've ever done. But that being said, if it were easy, everybody and their brother could and probably would do it. Our suggestion.
That's right.
Right? Am I right, Judy? Everybody would do
it.
If it were easy.
On my desk, I have a plaque that says opportunity, and there's a picture of a sailboat on the water, and it says, don't wait for your ship to come in, swim out to it.
See, that's another good one. I love that one. Because, ladies and gentlemen, if you sit around and wait for something to happen, you're going to die with cobwebs hanging off of you. Sitting around waiting for something to happen. Now, just picture that. You're going to turn into a skeleton waiting for something to happen. If you want it bad enough, you go out and you get it. I'm not saying
right.
Don't go out with the thing of I'm entitled to it, because none of us are entitled to anything. But you go out and you make it happen. And if your child...
Yeah.
Or your spouse, or your significant other, or your best friend, or your parent, or your sibling has a dream, do yourself a favor. Encourage them. Support
Absolutely.
Them. Because if you don't, and then you have a dream you want to make happen, what's going to happen, Judy?
Yeah, nobody's going to support you. You've got to support each other. And you have to pay things forward. You have to pay your good fortune forward. Like, absolutely, if somebody's done you a good turn, whatever that good turn might be, it's your obligation as a human being to pay that good turn forward to somebody else.
Absolutely. Because, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to tell you, so many people have helped me in my journey. Of course, there were a lot of naysayers, but I just thank them every day for telling me no. But so many other people have been kind to me and have helped me, encouraged me, and picked me up when I fell on my face or when I said I'm tossing this out the window because I'm over it. I can never pay those people back, and this is why I do the radio show. I cannot pay people back for what they've done for me, but I can pay it forward. I can have people like my new friend Judy, who I can't wait to read her books, my musicians who I promote now on Sunday nights. I can get them out there where they're heard in places they might not ever be heard if it weren't for the radio show. And this show is only as successful as my guests are, and that is very important to me. This is not my show. It is their show. They make it happen. Judy, I want to thank you so much, my dear, for spending an hour with me. It flew by so fast. And let me know when that book gets ready to launch, because I would like to launch it on the show.
That'd be great.
Because by then we should be at 20,000 easy in about.
Oh, maybe I can even do a giveaway or something, you know?
Yeah, we can do that. We absolutely
can
do that. So You heard that first here, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to bring Judy back. We're going to launch her book on the show, and she might do a giveaway. So, y'all, start following the show. And what I say at the end of every show, ladies and gentlemen, is don't be that person, the shoulda, woulda, coulda person. Go out and grab your dreams. Tomorrow night, filmmaker Dee McCulley is going to be back on the show with me, and this man has been up to, I can't tell you what all he's been up to. So join us tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and love yourself, love your children, love your spouse, love your significant other, and stop asking permission to achieve greatness. And with that being said, this is Yvonne Mason and author Judy Pins Selleck. I got it right that time. And we're saying good night from Off the Chain. Okay. Now, the show is off the air, Judy, but I did want to reiterate that as soon as we get off of here and this thing archives, I'm going to put it up on my page and tag you in it. And then tomorrow I'll put all the beautiful podcast up and tag you in that as well. And thank you again for joining me tonight. Oh, she hung up.